Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Accidental Admiral, A Sailor Takes Command at NATO, by Admiral James Stavridis, United States Navy, retired. Narrated by Bob Sauer. Preface. A tweet. In less than 140 characters, I accidentally encapsulated my time as Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. It was October 2011, and I was preparing to recommend to the North Atlantic Council ambassadors that we conclude combat operations in Libya. For the previous 8 months, we had been pounding the Libyan regime daily using precision-guided munitions on our UN-authorized mission to protect the people of Libya from the brutal Gaddafi regime. After more than 24,000 strikes and 3,000 at-sea intercepts, it was clear that the people of Libya were in control of their own destiny, and I felt it was time for us to call a halt to Operation Unified Protector. But I caused a diplomatic stir by sending out a tweet to the world explaining what I would recommend to the 28 ambassadors later that day. News organizations picked it up, and soon the story of the first war whose end was announced on Twitter was making the rounds. When I went to Brussels to brief the ambassadors, I faced some resistance, not because anyone wanted to continue combat operations, but because I had violated some unwritten rule on diplomatic communications. The French ambassador, a good friend, in particular, seemed quite miffed about my faux pas. Such is NATO, where no innovation goes unchallenged, even in good cause. But the good news was that it was good news. The Council accepted the recommendation a few days later, and the most successful NATO operation of my time in command came to a reasonably happy outcome. I continued to tweet early and often. At the beginning of my Navy career, I never dreamed that I would end up a four-star admiral in command of all NATO operations and would tweet to the end of a war. In fact, my plan was to graduate from Annapolis, serve for the obligatory 5 years, and head off to law school. Yet I sailed on well past the 5-year limit and recently finished 37 years in uniform. It all seems an accidental outcome in so many ways, as is true for nearly everyone's life, I suppose. Our plans never quite survive contact with the real world. My plan collided with reality this way. As my 5-year commitment ended in early 1981, I had applications in at Yale Law School, waitlisted, and a number of other prestigious schools of law, accepted at several. I had submitted my resignation to the Navy and was about to begin what I hoped would be an interesting and profitable career as a corporate lawyer. Then Mike Mullen called me. At the time, the future chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was a lieutenant commander working in the Bureau of Naval Personnel. He had been a company officer at Annapolis during my time there and was an early mentor who helped me decide on the surface Navy as opposed to submarines, aviation, or the Marine Corps. "Stavridis, what is this I hear about you getting out?" was his opening line, delivered as usual without preamble or foreplay. I explained why I wanted to go to law school, assured him that I had loved the Navy but really wanted to try something else, and laid out what I thought was a defendable argument for my exodus. "You want law school? Okay, let me try and get the Navy to send you to a law school. I'll call you back." Dial tone. The next day he called and offered to have the Navy send me to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I pointed out that Fletcher was not a law school but a school of international relations. His comment, "It has law in the name, and it is hard to get orders to it, so you better take it now." I was assigned to an aircraft carrier at the time, operating out of semi-tropical North Florida, my home. I liked my job, although it was hard work in the engineering department. Several other factors came to bear about the same time. One was my real affection for the sea, and perhaps the beginnings of a belief that one day I could be a reasonably good officer, and perhaps even a sea captain. Another was more prosaic, the cost of law school. Navy lieutenants at the time were unlikely to sock away a lot of money, and I had not done so. And the third delightful factor was that I had recently become engaged to my lovely future wife, Laura. A Navy junior herself, Laura, it seemed to me, would be happier in the embrace of the Navy family. A Navy scholarship to graduate school to study international relations would guarantee that, at least for the 3-year obligation period following. And Laura wanted to study international relations as well, which had been her undergraduate major. So I stayed in the Navy and studied at the Fletcher School, ultimately graduating with a Ph.D. Laura went to Boston University to do her graduate work, also in international relations. In many ways, that was the pivotal moment in my career, that nexus in time we all face when two roads permanently and irrevocably part and a decision is made. While I toyed again with getting out several more times in my career, essentially the die was cast at that moment. The decision to stay in the Navy was obviously key, but the decisions, both mine and the Navy personnel systems, that led to my assignment in 2009 as the Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, SACUR, began with my time in graduate school studying international relations. It was at the Fletcher School that I first learned to appreciate the key interplay of politics, economics, finance, business, culture, language, and security. The knowledge and skills I developed there helped me many times throughout the long voyage of my career and came most pointedly into play in my first four-star assignment to U.S. Southern Command and then at NATO. That time in graduate school also began my thinking about an important idea, one that I have written this book to share. The big lesson that I learned along the way, and which is the underpinning of this book, is in one sense very basic. The world is a diverse and complex place, and single-point silver bullet solutions for its problems will almost always fail. Unilateral action is usually a disappointment. Alliances, partnerships, and friendships are everything. We must apply international, interagency, and public-private connections in creating security in the 21st century. And it all must be done in a transparent and open way that leverages our ultimate strengths. The Enlightenment values that undergird all that our nation and the other democracies of the world stand for: liberty, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of education, democracy itself, and on and on. Ideas must be spread through effective strategic communication using the social networks where the world lives today. I hope to illuminate not so much what happened during the turbulent 4 years I spent at NATO from 2009 to 2013. The facts of those years are already well documented and readily available from many sources. The issues were large: Afghanistan, Libya, the Balkans, Syria, cybercrime, cyberterrorism, piracy, missile defense, defense funding cuts, unbalanced spending within the NATO alliance, and many other things, both good and ill. Instead, I want to offer more about why it happened and what I learned from it. Perhaps most important from my own personal perspective, I hope to give a glimpse of what it is like to serve as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander, the successes and failures, the good decisions and mistakes, the high and low points of the voyage. It is a job I never expected, a Navy admiral chosen for what has always been a general's task. Although I was something of an accidental choice, as you will hear in this book, the voyage was a fascinating one, and from it we may together learn a bit about how to create security in this unsettled and dangerous century. Finally, I have long believed that we must all dare to read, think, write, and publish. No one of us is as smart as all of us thinking together. No one person, no one nation, no one alliance, no one organization. Our combined knowledge is vastly greater than our individual inputs. So ideas must be shared, and strategic communication, our self-talk, matters deeply. Throughout my career, I have written extensively, not so much to teach others as to help myself learn. At the start of my time as SACUR, I began to keep a journal about my thoughts and experiences in the job. It was only the second time in my career that I had done so, the first being during my first command at sea of a Navy destroyer. By the time I stepped down in May 2013, I had assembled about 250,000 words covering my thoughts during those four tumultuous years. I draw on those contemporaneous insights and feelings often in the course of this book. In many cases, the quotes I include were directly recorded in my journal. In other instances, they are recreated to the best of my recollection. What I hope to show in this volume is that in our complex world, the best approach is an honest recognition that things will fail, mistakes will be made, and the costs will be high. but we can succeed in creating security for our nations by working together with allies, partners, and friends, by creating true interagency cooperation in our own executive branch, and by partnering with the private sector in which the real power of this nation resides. I would offer a final word about the people in the U.S. Department of Defense and the free militaries of the NATO alliance, virtually all volunteers in the cause of freedom. More than 2,000 years ago, the nascent Greek democracy faced an existential threat from the Empire of Persia. The Persians came with a mighty fleet of triremes to conquer Greece, and they outnumbered the Greek fleet by more than 5-1. Yet the Greek fleet's Athenian admiral, Themistocles, knew that he had one crucial advantage. His rowers were all freemen, while the Persian fleet was manned overwhelmingly by slaves. The night before the battle in the Bay of Salamis outside Athens, Themistocles gathered the captains of all his trireme galleys. He told them to tell their men four things the next day at dawn before they rowed into battle. Tomorrow you must row for your parents. Tomorrow you must row for your children. Tomorrow you must row for your city. And tomorrow you must row for freedom. The Greeks destroyed the Persian fleet, and the values of democracy, freedom, and liberty were saved, eventually to be passed on to us. The NATO alliance and the good men and women who serve it today continue to row for freedom. I am proud to have spent 4 years with them at the oars. This book is the story of that voyage. Chapter 1. You want to send me where? If you do not change direction, you may end up where you are heading. Lao Tzu. Often in my dreams I am at sea on a ship again. I am either the captain, a middle-aged man in my late 30s, in command, feeling serious but pleased with my seemingly heavy responsibilities, or, on increasingly infrequent occasions, a happy young junior officer in my early 20s standing watch and giving rudder orders to the helmsman. Then it gets hard. We are always approaching the shore after a long voyage. There is a pier which looks safe and simple to approach, but at the last minute some unseen higher commander orders us to proceed up a river, always the worst place for a warship. At first it goes well. There is plenty of water and sunlight, and the channel is well marked. But after a time the banks of the river close in, and heavy foliage on both shores prevents me from seeing what dangers may threaten my ship. All very Joseph Conrad and Heart of Darkness. The worst part is that the river grows increasingly shallow. Soon we are simply skimming along on a plain of mud, and I cannot imagine how the ship stays upright. It should tip over. But somehow we are cruising along, and I am adding power to the engines to keep us precariously thrusting forward, awaiting the ship's inevitable fall to one side or the other. Then I awake. I walked out of the office of Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in February 2008, feeling slightly disoriented. He had just asked me to become the first Navy admiral to serve as the Supreme Allied Commander of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The position, known by the acronym SACUR, was first held by Dwight Eisenhower. Since Ike, an unbroken line of 15 generals had done the job. For a guy who never expected to make it beyond lieutenant, it was an awesome prospect, in the literal meaning of the word. And it came with a second four-star assignment. The term in the military is dual-hatted, as commander of U.S. European Command, EUCOM. I would have two headquarters, more than 300 miles apart, two distinct staffs, and a world of challenges. I was flattered and honored, but I asked for some time to think about it before I said yes. After 32 years of commissioned service following my graduation from Annapolis in 1976, I was still relatively young at 53 and excited about my career. I was certainly hopeful of another assignment, but before my visit with Bob Gates that morning, I would have guessed that I was about to be offered the job of commander at U.S. Pacific Command, traditionally a Navy post. Yet the offer to go to Europe was not a complete surprise. I was close to finishing my 3-year tour as the combatant commander of U.S. Southern Command, responsible for all Department of Defense activity south of the United States. I was the first Navy officer to land that job as well. My area of focus comprised 45 countries and territories, 16 million square miles, and well over 500 million people. I loved the job and had spent much of my time, nearly 70%, traveling throughout the Americas. My Spanish had improved to the point that I conducted all my meetings with my interlocutors from down south in Spanish, and I was studying Portuguese. From my headquarters in Miami, I led a team of tens of thousands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, coast guardsmen, and defense civilians engaged in security cooperation and operations. But all good things end, and it was clear that I would either take on a new assignment or be asked to retire after nearly 33 years of commissioned service. I was comfortable either way. My nomination for the job in Europe made some sense. I spoke reasonable French and Spanish, and my Ph.D. from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, the nation's oldest school of international relations, had a strong concentration in European studies, history, politics, NATO, and security studies. Laura had lived in Europe for 6 years as a child and spoke French, and I had lived for 3 years in Greece as a child myself. I had operated extensively under NATO command at sea in the Mediterranean over the years, and during my time as senior military assistant to the Secretary of Defense, we had gone to many, many conferences and meetings engaging the NATO allies. I considered myself reasonably well qualified to help manage the three great issues facing NATO: Afghanistan, where almost 100,000 NATO troops were in combat against the Taliban; Russia, a difficult and contentious relationship with a huge downside if we could not get it right; and the geostrategic future of the alliance itself. Kosovo and the Balkans were also concerns, although things seemed to be going, as I would come to say later, suspiciously well there. Not a single admiral, however, had ever been assigned to the twin positions of SACUR and EUCOM, command of NATO's forces and all of the U.S. forces in a geographic area that includes Europe, Russia, Israel, and a major segment of the Atlantic. It was daunting to consider following in the footsteps of Dwight Eisenhower, Alexander Haig, John Shalikashvili, Wesley Clark, Joseph Ralston, James Jones, and all the others. I was glad that I would continue to work for Bob Gates if I took the job. Gates was a career CIA officer, Russia expert, and Ph.D. with Russian language skills, and above all, a steady hand amid the controversy and challenges of Washington, D.C. I was happy to continue on Admiral Mike Mullen's team as well. He is a lifelong mentor and superb chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Another plus was the chance to work with General James Jones, who had just been selected to be National Security Advisor to newly elected President Barack Obama. General Jones had been both the commander of the Marine Corps and the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. A bilingual French speaker who grew up in Switzerland, he had been a fine example and occasional mentor to me for more than a decade, and I knew I could count on him for solid advice and counsel in my new job. At least I can practice my French with him, I thought. But above all else, in my heart, I was not quite ready to hang up my uniform. Laura, my beautiful blonde wife of 28 years, and I sat in Central, a relatively new restaurant on Pennsylvania Avenue, and talked about the pluses and minuses of the assignment to NATO. We'd chosen a French bistro-style spot to discuss the job. I knew Laura's sharp judgment and deep knowledge of Europe would be invaluable assets in the tour. She had even attended 3 years of high school in Belgium, while her father, a Navy captain, was assigned to the NATO mission in Brussels. We agreed that the only real downside about going to SACUR would be leaving South Florida and accepting the geographical separation from our two daughters and our aging, but fortunately still vigorous, parents. And Laura and I loved Miami, a gorgeous city, one of the most beautiful in the country, with its sweeping harbor, sunny beaches, lovely Art Deco buildings, and bustling Latino culture. More than half of the metro area's residents were born in other countries, and well over 60% of conversations are conducted in Spanish. Miami is truly sui generis. I also had in hand a reasonable prospect of a fantastic job working for Donna Shalala, the president of the University of Miami, a person I deeply admire and respect. But despite our love for Miami and the chance of a good job in academia, we both quickly came to the conclusion that I could not say no to the opportunity I had just been offered to serve in Europe. We returned to Miami and started preparing for a midsummer move. Like all military families, we had moved many, many times before. Both Laura and I grew up in the military. I, in a Marine Corps family, my father was a decorated infantry officer, and Laura, the daughter of a naval aviator. Even before we married in 1981, our combined moves exceeded 20, including between us 3 tours in Europe. Since our marriage, we'd pulled up stakes and moved 13 times, often going coast to coast in the typical roller coaster of a military career. Yet surprisingly, this was the first time in my career that I would be based overseas. Although my ships had made numerous deployments, Laura and our 2 daughters had always been homeported in the United States. This new assignment came at a complicated time for our high school senior, Julia. Like most young people about to leave the nest and head for college, Julia had been hoping to be reasonably close to us, especially for the first year or two. At one point, when it looked like a job in Hawaii was an option, she had applied and been accepted at the University of Hawaii. But with a posting to Belgium, there was no U.S. collegiate option for her any closer than the U.S. East Coast, a long 6-hour flight away. We spent much of the weekend discussing the options and trying to focus Julia on the huge upside of the assignment for her: trips to Europe, a built-in summer experience, the chance to learn French, and she gradually squared her shoulders and settled into the idea. A disciplined figure skater and a fine student, Julia would be a success wherever she went to college, and as a Navy junior, she had learned to roll with the punches. The move was a similar surprise to Julia's older sister, Christina, who had recently graduated from the University of Virginia and was working at Google in San Francisco. Like her sister, Christina had hoped her mom and dad would be posted to Hawaii, which would have put us closer to her on the U.S. West Coast. She had turned down a job with Google in Dublin, Ireland earlier in the year, betting on our coming west. But like Julia, Christina had great reserves of character and flexibility, and after a couple of long phone calls with Laura, she too was focusing clearly on the new home port, Mons, Belgium. While the Secretary of Defense proposes people for jobs like the one I had been asked to consider, the position is not the Secretary's to award. The President must nominate officers for such jobs. The Senate must confirm those appointments, and in the case of senior NATO assignments, the North Atlantic Council's 28 ambassadors must also approve. So once I had decided in principle that I would take the job, I had to go through several more steps before it was all nailed down. On a cold Wednesday afternoon in Washington, I was summoned to the White House to meet President Obama. I had read Dreams from My Father some months before. It was the first book I downloaded to my Kindle, and found it reassuring to know that our new president was a fine writer. The book has a real literary quality, as well as clearly being highly intelligent, adaptable, internationally oriented, and manifestly curious. Good qualities indeed in a leader. And I resonated to his no-drama style, which was part of my bedrock approach to leadership. Over the years, I had met 5 presidents, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and both Bushes, so this was not the first time I would be shaking hands with the leader of the free world. But the circumstances, a chat about my next job, an important one in the context of the Department of Defense, were different. So my nerves were running high as I went through the normal routine of a day in Washington: a speech, several calls on key congressional leaders, and a quick lunch in my small Pentagon office. The appointed time was 3 p.m., and I had told my security team to get me there plenty early. I walked into the west wing of the White House, took a deep breath, and was escorted by a staffer to the Oval Office. I was told to take a seat just inside the door and wait for someone to come and get me. I had arrived about 20 minutes early and was hoping to connect with Secretary Gates, who would be accompanying me to the session, for a moment or two before meeting the president. I opened my Kindle and pretended to read. In fact, I was working through possible answers to questions I thought the president might ask. What did I think was the right way ahead in Afghanistan? I decided I would truthfully say that I wanted to see the results of the major reviews that were underway. Joint Staff, National Security Staff, and U.S. Central Command all had such efforts in progress before committing. But I felt it was safe to say that I saw the needs in terms of 3 main areas: international cooperation, particularly NATO, but also Russia, Pakistan, and even Iran; interagency, getting all involved agencies of the government coordinated from the Agency for International Development, AID, to the Departments of State, Defense, and Justice, to the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, etc., and local, Without competent Afghan security forces, we would never get out of the country. I also ran the tape of my thoughts on Russia. I'd always felt that there was little substantive that outsiders could do to influence the Russians' behavior. They sort of rolled the cosmic dice. One time they'd get Peter the Great, the next roll of the dice would bring Ivan the Terrible. Roll again and get Stalin, and the next time Gorbachev. I looked at Putin as an unfortunate roll of the dice, at least from a Western perspective, and he was clearly taking the Russians in an anti-U.S., anti-Western direction, influenced by his own career in the KGB and by Russians' inherent suspicion of the West. My thought was that we actually needed to enlarge the relationship and convert it to a more global level, to move beyond such essentially tactical issues as the missile defense installations in Eastern Europe, and engage Russia on the Pacific, proliferation, global warming, energy security, and other more universal topics. I was also concerned about the expansion of the NATO alliance, which I did not count at that moment as necessarily serving U.S. interests. When a nation joins NATO, the other members agree to come to that nation's defense. An attack on one is considered an attack on all. But both Ukraine and Georgia, which wanted NATO membership, would be a hard sell to the U.S. public in terms of defending them. And the Russians considered both to be part of a greater Russia in ways that Poland, the Czech Republic, and even the Baltic states were not. Over time, I would come to be strongly supportive of Georgia's membership, and less so of Ukraine's. But that was ahead. At the moment, I was simply cautious on both counts and planned to make that point with the president. Suddenly, Admiral Michael Mullen, who also would be attending my job interview, popped his head into the anteroom and motioned to me to follow him into the Oval Office. I'd been there before for several briefings in the Bush era as a backbencher, but this was my first time as the center of attention. President Obama rose from his chair and walked over, loose-limbed and very relaxed. His smile was very welcoming, and he put out a hand and said simply, "Admiral, congratulations. I hear some wonderful things about you from all these folks," waving his other hand at Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen. "I know you're going to do a fine job for us in Europe." Well, so much for the job interview. It was clear he had decided to nominate me for the job. I was struck by the president's height, but that was not unusual. Virtually everyone towers over my compact 5-foot-5-inch frame. We chatted about several issues having to do with Europe, including Afghanistan and Russia, and he concluded by saying how thankful he was for the work I was doing down south in Miami, and how much he looked forward to working with me in my new post. I thanked him, and after 15 minutes of friendly conversation, I excused myself. On the way out, I stopped to chat for a moment with General Jim Jones, the president's national security advisor. He congratulated me, and I promised to call him right away to get his views of the job. In my view, no one had been a better SACUR than Jones since General Eisenhower inaugurated the position. I walked out to my car, half smiling to myself. It was an extraordinary moment in my life, and I had a good feeling about both the job and my new boss. Some weeks before, back when I didn't know whether there were any more jobs for me in uniform, or whether I would accept one if it were offered, I had started to think about a second career. One opportunity that came on my radar screen was truly enticing. Dean of the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at the University of Miami. I had been very interested in the position. The job looked ideal. It was in a city I loved, on a beautiful campus on Virginia Key, with a chance to work for Donna Shalala and lots of potential to move the school ahead nationally. It was with reluctance that I withdrew from consideration for the job in order to take one more assignment in uniform. Oh, well, I thought, the chance of a lifetime only comes around once a month or so, as the saying goes. There will be another time. And so closed a very tempting chapter in my life. Ojalá, a Spanish term meaning God willing that comes from the Arabic inshallah, something equally attractive will come along in a few years, I prayed. One night, at about that time, I had another dream that comes to me every month or so. I am back again on my beloved First Command at Sea, USS Barry, a brand new Arleigh Burke-class Aegis guided missile destroyer. Despite all my efforts, the ship runs aground. I hasten to say this never happened during the 28 months I was actually in command in the mid-1990s. There are variations on what happens in the dream from this point, but generally we are able to float free with little damage and a huge sense of relief, and then make our way through a suddenly open channel to the deep ocean. My dream that night had an entirely different ending. Suddenly I was no longer the captain, but was in fact a 4-star admiral embarked on the ship. I realized that I would have to do a better job in training the young captain standing next to me, and I realized I had not done a good job thus far. When I awoke and thought about the dream, it occurred to me that I was finally letting go of those early years in command, as I potentially headed off to my second.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?